Support for Studio 360's podcast comes from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are like a personal trainer for your brain, improving your performance with the science of neuroplasticity, but in a way that just feels like games. Start training today at Lumosity.com.
Today in Studio 360,
my son gathered misfits, although he himself, despite everything, was not a misfit.
An extraordinary new one-woman show makes us totally rethink the Virgin Mary. The actress Fiona Shaw figured out in surprising ways how to play the character.
We were having breakfast in a diner, and there was a woman with a fur coat who came down the street, and she was a very respectable lady, but she was definitely alone on a Sunday morning, and I thought, that's her!
I'll talk with Fiona Shaw about The Testament of Mary on Broadway. And the hot new British pop star Jessie Ware stops by to sing and talk. She co-wrote her new record, Devotion, without ever picking up an instrument.
My guitarist says he'll teach me, but I have to get rid of the false nails, and I just can't part with them at the moment.
That and more is ahead this hour in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC, right after this.
You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
Support for Studio 360 comes from the car company Scion, helping others follow their passions for nearly 10 years. Scion's Motivate program helps young entrepreneurs take their business to the next level. In March, Scion selected 10 semifinalists and will track their success over the next 3 months. Learn more at scion.com.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. On today's show, a young singer from South London who's breaking big with the U.S. release of her first album this week. Jessie Ware stops by to perform later in the show. But first,
we woke up to this headline this morning, North Korea threatening a preemptive nuclear attack against the United States.
It's been the same old saber-rattling crazy talk out of North Korea for the last month or so, just a lot more of it. Declarations that the 60-year-old armistice is over, warnings of imminent nuclear war on the Korean Peninsula, maps showing specific American targets. So the timing of this week's announcement of the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction was exceptionally apt. The winning novel, Adam Johnson's The Orphan Master's Son, is a kind of thriller love story set inside North Korea. And Adam Johnson joins me from Stanford University, where he teaches creative writing. Adam, welcome to Studio 360, and congratulations. Entirely a surprise or not?
It's absolutely a surprise. Someone congratulated me before I'd heard, and I kind of barked at him, and I said, don't say things like that.
So this bizarrely closed-off country, North Korea, with its nightmarish weirdness and this singular psychology of North Koreans. Did you ever worry that writing a serious novel about this horrific, tragic place, but still doing humor, was just an exceptionally high degree of difficulty?
Oh, you know, I have many answers to that, probably. You know, when you read the testimonies of defectors, they have a dark sense of humor about their experience. And it's one of the ways that gallows humor that they do with it. And to take that away would have been, I don't know, to dehumanize the place in some way. You know, I just wrote a long article for GQ interviewing Kim Jong-il's personal chef, who was Kim Jong-il's sidekick for 11 years. And Kim Jong-il played pranks. He liked to do fraternity-type humor. He was always cracking jokes. Of course, you had to laugh or you'd be shot.
Yeah. Was there any challenge writing about a real place, fictionally, that seems so fictional?
Well, the difference between fiction and nonfiction is that fiction must be believable. We read nonfiction pieces all the time about gigantic, you know, waves or perfect storms or 9/11, things that you could probably never earn in fiction. And I found that to be very true in writing about North Korea. A lot of the true absurdity of Kim Jong-il's life and the Kim regime I had to leave out, a lot of the true darkness I had to leave out in studying the Kwanli-so, the gulag systems there. the abortions, the executions, the amputations. Even I couldn't handle reading about that after a certain point, and I tried to put it into the book, but it was just, I think it's too dark for a Western reader. We just didn't have a bridge to it.
Well, and I'm wondering if that's one of the reasons you chose as a sort of central narrative driver of this novel, this romantic story, this over-the-top love of the main character for a famous woman. Was that a way of making it seem not so relentlessly, horrifically dark?
Well, I don't know if the love was over the top. I'm a very romantic guy, Kurt, so it seemed very natural to me.
Really? Well, yes. Then you and I are different. But anyway, okay. I mean, there is this love story at the center that rather than being all about politics and totalitarian brutality.
Well, seriously, though, when I was writing the book, the question I kept asking is, what if, you know, I was raising my children there? Normal families like mine are put under pressures that we can't really conceive of. And my real question was, how do you be a parent? How do you have a relationship? How do you have a private life in a world where every one of those things can imperil you? And I felt like family and love and identity had to be at the center of the book in terms of investigation.
Yeah. And as someone who has spent the better part of a decade thinking about the North Korean regime and their psychology, what's your bet about the end game?
Well, I'm no expert on the geopolitics or the nuclear military dimension. I really just tried to find the human dimension. One thing I'll say is that Koreans are a very resilient people. They've had a tough last 100 years, 35 years of subjugation at the hands of the Japanese, World War II, you know, partition by the superpowers, the Korean War, a very difficult war, 60 years of a totalitarian dictatorship. And, you know, say what you will about the Kim regime, these people have not been occupied by a foreign power for 60 years in the North, and they see that as their greatest achievement after a millennium of being a plaything of, you know, Mongolia, of China and Japan. And I don't see anything changing on the horizon.
And as somebody who lives on the West Coast, are you any more worried today than you were a year ago about North Korean incursions?
I think it's quite possible that we'll see, you know, something small scale happen in North Korea. You know, Kim Jong-un is a figure who was raised by a deeply paranoid man and a man who had many reasons to be paranoid. In fact, some say paranoia is a healthy state of existence in North Korea. One of the things his father was really famous for was loyalty testing people. Give them a chance to escape and see if they did, or make them kill another human being. All of these are documented. I kind of feel like Kim Jong-un is loyalty testing his nation.
Adam Johnson, thank you very much.
Thanks for taking the time to talk with me, Kurt.
Adam Johnson is a professor of creative writing at Stanford University. He won the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction this week for his novel, The Orphan Master's Son. I am not a religious person, but I'm about to evangelize for a play opening on Broadway. It's called The Testament of Mary. It's a one-woman show with Fiona Shaw playing Mary, the mother of Jesus. This Mary tells a version of the Passion that I find entirely plausible and illuminating. Horrible for her, thrilling for her son's excited true believer disciples. Fiona Shaw's performance is one of maybe the half dozen most powerful stage performances I think I've ever seen, and she is here with me now. Fiona Shaw, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you so much.
As a non-Christian, to me, Mary has always seemed like a kind of saintly blank. As someone raised Catholic, did you have a sense of who this person was?
Saintly blank is very good. Actually, that's exactly what she was being proffered as. She wore pale blue. She was in statues. She had no personality. She never said anything in the New Testament to make any of the Gospels interesting on a Sunday. She sort of hung around on the side, passive, watery, milky, actually, kind of milky.
And sort of invites a filling in by a presumptuous playwright.
Yes, it does. And I think the really good thing is that, you know, why should she not have been a mother of a family or married to a husband who she loved as much as anyone else. But the church was so busy, the early church, trying to neutralize the power of the female, I think.
Right. So she had to be this two-dimensional sort
yes.
of figure.
Yeah.
As you were thinking about how to do this Mary, I mean, obviously, there was the text. But did you have a modern person in mind?
Yes. I mean, I hope the trick of the play is that you're meeting somebody you might meet in Brooklyn. And funny enough, when I first arrived in New York just a month ago, we were having breakfast in a diner, and there was a woman with a fur coat who came down the street, and she was a very respectable lady, but she was definitely alone on a Sunday morning. And I thought, that's her. So she's around.
Would you, before we talk some more, perform a little bit of it for us?
Sure.
You looked worried.
I did. You took me by surprise there. I mean, it's also not without humour, the play.
Absolutely.
And
I was the first to laugh a little too loudly.
Yeah, I could laugh away. I think most plays should have humour. But she is a woman who, of course, the difficult thing is when you've witnessed something as horrible as she has, which is to witness the death of your son, you never really recover. But within that, she has fantastic irony, and Cullum has written, Cullum Tobin, who wrote the novel, a sort of fantastic point of view of this woman, of her point of view, of her son's friends.
And it's unclear how long after the fact she's telling us
this
story.
Yes, I think it's about 6 or 7 years, say, after the death of her son. But she spends a lot of the time trying to work out, how did it go so wrong? How did she lose this boy? And she starts to talk about her son's friends, and these, you know, became famously, iconically, the evangelists and the apostles. But from her point of view, she says, he gathered around him, I said, a group of misfits, only children like himself, or men without fathers, men who could not look a woman in the eye, men who were seen smiling to themselves. Not one of you was normal, I said. Yes, misfits, I said. I've no time for misfits. My son gathered misfits, although he himself, despite everything, was not a misfit. He could have done anything. He could have even been quiet. He had that quality too. He could look at a woman as though she were his equal. He was graceful, good-mannered, he was intelligent, and he used all of it, I said, to lead a group of misfits from place to place. Gather together misfits, I said, and you will get recklessness, you'll get ambition, you'll get anything at all, and it will lead to what I saw, which is the worst sort of catastrophe. And I watched him pushing a plate of half-eaten food towards me like a child in a tantrum.
That is Fiona Shaw doing part of The Testament of Mary, in which she's appearing now in on Broadway. That is one of my favorite recurring parts of her discussion, is the followers. And she says the followers in invisible quotation marks, essentially.
Yes. I mean, I think that is both shocking to people. And yet, of course, Cullum has just, with great imagination, filled in that if you have no hindsight before the event, you have no idea of how important these people were going to be later. So it's very likely that the mother of this famous young man does not see these 12 friends as anything but a bunch of strange guys who seem to be not doing a job of work but up to something else. But it never really lampoons. It's not that it diminishes or lampoons them. She just genuinely finds them not ordinary people. And, of course, that is true.
As opposed to my good son, who's not a misfit.
Yes, and like all mothers, yes, she said he could do anything. You know, he could have been anything, a doctor or a lawyer.
Or a carpenter.
Or a carpenter.
What would your parents think of this play?
Well, my mother is going to come, actually, next month.
Really?
And I think she'll enjoy it very much.
Is she a churchgoer?
She's very much a churchgoer, but she's very clear about the difference between fiction and religion. And so she will happily watch it and run the other hair of her belief in her head, which is why I think there's a great pleasure for some people. Whether you're Christian or not Christian, the joy of it is that that story has influenced, you know, art history, clothing history, the way we speak.
The way we think.
The way we think. So everybody has some access to the story, and they will enjoy playing their version in their head versus what they're watching.
So she's not going to go, oh, Fiona, how could you do this?
She's very keen that it doesn't upset anyone.
It has upset a few people. There were members of this right-wing Catholic group protesting outside the theater at least one night. What do you think most upsets them?
I think not seeing the play. Actually, I think if they saw the play, they would be absolutely delighted by it. There's nothing in the play apart from the fact that, you know, there is a storyline where she leaves the crucifixion. But even in the New Testament, it's only in Luke that she is present at the crucifixion. So it's it's not theology, but I think they would be overall the tenor of it, and the profound upset at the death of this young man is the essence of our suffering as people, secular or Christian.
And I agree with you because, again, you know, I know the basic story, but I was not indoctrinated with its sacred sense growing up. But I found myself more caring more, thinking more about Mary and the crucifixion and Christianity than I ever had before.
But it is a marvelous story because in the New Testament, when we get it in church, when we're all bored, rigid as children and we have to listen to it, or even, you know, even in the Old Testament, I'm sure Jewish children have the same thing with this strange, vague world called the Old World where this thing happened. Fundamentally, the stories are about people, and that once you understand things emotionally, you understand them much better historically. And I think that's where drama has a miracle of its own, actually, that you actually meet these people in a way that you just cannot in the austere world of an open Bible.
You have played a lot of larger-than-life mythic women, Euripides, Medea, Beckett's Winnie, now the Virgin Mary. Go big or go home is your rule here?
I think not. I think this was started by the Greeks, I think, who always saw that women were the lowest form of human life and therefore made them often the center of their plays. Because if the gods were going to attack you, or the fates, or some story that was going to reveal something, as a man, you had the defense of your sword or your manlyhood. Women have pretty well no defense. So Euripides and Sophocles wrote these Electras, and obviously,
right,
and they also wrote, obviously, they're men. You know, the whole Oresteias are mainly about men, but they do make women very important in their plays, which, apart from anything else, gives women something to play, that they're in relation to the universe, to infinity, to death, and to family.
It's unmediated.
Oh, yeah. For something, actually, they're not just on the side while, you know, some argument is happening in a democracy where the men are discussing the situation. The women themselves are directly affected. And later, I mean, Shakespeare wrote some fantastic heroines, but he didn't write near as many as he did great heroes. So I played a lot of those heroines. You get through them quite quickly, actually, once you've done Beatrice, Portia, and Rosalind.
So on to Richard II.
On to Richard II. But I've also done, I mean, Hedda Gabler is a very ordinary person. That is the point about her.
Yes.
She's mediocre in every respect. And
who explodes surprisingly.
Yeah. But there's nothing mythic about her, really.
That's
except
true.
That she is.
But she has become mythic in 100 years since.
She has. And maybe our job is often, you take the myth, like in Medea, the great myth of this person, and you actually discover her, too, to be a very ordinary person in relation to her desires. Because in the end, the theatre is about literally each of us.
Which is exactly what this great play does.
Yeah.
Fiona Shaw, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Fiona Shaw stars in The Testament of Mary. It's running on Broadway through the end of June. Coming up, if there's one picture we all know that embodies and illustrates the Great Depression, the photograph Migrant Mother.
What would Dorothea Lange's own portrait look like if she did it herself, of her and her children and her husband, instead of someone from outside that was commissioned by the government?
The latest installment in our American Icons series is just ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Support for Studio 360 comes from the car company Scion, helping others follow their passions for nearly 10 years. Scion's Motivate program helps young entrepreneurs take their business to the next level. In March, Scion selected 10 semifinalists and will track their success over the next 3 months. Learn more at scion.com. And from Air France, serving wine and champagne in every cabin. Air France, the official carrier for Marseille, Provence 2013, European Capital of Culture. Daily flights to Marseille at airfrance.us.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Dorothea Lange and Florence Thompson. You may not know their names, but you almost certainly know the photograph that ties them together. Lange was one of the great documentary photographers of the mid-20th century. Thompson, her most famous subject. The picture was Migrant Mother.
With my students, I have several times said, "What's your image of the Great Depression?" Stop right there. And they describe that picture.
That got WNYC's Charlie Herman wondering. In the wake of our own Great Recession, where is the image that sums up these difficult economic times? As part of our ongoing series on American icons, we take a closer look at Dorothea Lange's migrant mother.
The first thing you should know about the making of the photograph is that it almost didn't happen. The second thing is that both women came to wish it hadn't. It was a rainy day, February 1936. Dorothea Lange was driving home to Berkeley, California. She'd been on the road for about a month taking photographs of migrant workers for the federal government. And just north of Santa Barbara in the town of Napomo, she saw a sign that read, Pea Pickers Camp. Lange was exhausted and she wanted to see her family, so she kept on driving. But she kept asking herself, what's the situation back there? So, 20 miles down the road, she turned the car around and drove back to the camp. There she met Florence Thompson.
I saw and approached the hungry and desperate mother as if drawn by a magnet. I do not remember how I explained my presence or my camera to her.
These are Lange's words about the making of the photo.
I made 5 exposures, working closer and closer from the same direction. I did not ask her name or her history.
In Lange's picture, Thompson is looking off into the distance. Her right hand is raised to her lips, and 2 of her children are pressing against her. There's a baby in her arms.
And she seemed to know that my pictures might help her, and so she helped me.
Now, keep in mind, this photo was just one of thousands of pictures that Dorothea Lange took while working for the Farm Security Administration. Of all the pictures that were taken by the FSA, why do you think this one stood out the most?
I think because of the maternalism.
Linda Gordon is a history professor at New York University and the author of the biography, Dorothea Lange, A Life Beyond Limits.
I think that's the main source. There's just something about seeing a mother with kids that is going to evoke sympathy.
The thing is, before she started photographing destitute farm workers, Lange had been a portrait photographer in San Francisco for years, and a very successful one. She knew how to frame an image, and she knew what she was doing when she transformed Thompson and her kids into this vision of a Madonna and child.
She saw something about the expressiveness of the woman's face and body, but she also put together a composition that might have been in a Renaissance painting.
Once the photograph was published, people, especially newspaper editors, loved it. There was this hunger for images about the Depression.
Starts with the New York Times, July 5th, 1936, San Francisco News, March 11th.
It appeared next to any story about people in hard times, not just the pea pickers in California. And since Lange's photo belonged to the federal government, there wasn't, and still isn't, any copyright limiting who used it or how.
Well, there is a Black Panther leaflet that has the migrant mother with an afro on the front page. Here's one from the Watchtower announcing Jehovah's Kingdom. There's one I know with perfume. There's one I know with Coach bags. Here's one selling Samsonite luggage.
What's the connection between that photograph and selling something like the Samsonite?
She's become what you would call an empty signifier. She doesn't actually mean what she originally meant to people. And Lange was furious about that. And she said, once I got a divorce from that picture, that picture doesn't belong to me.
The migrant mother, Florence Thompson, she threatened to sue. After seeing her face yet again in a magazine in 1958, she wrote, should the picture appear in any magazine again, I and my 3 daughters shall be forced to protect our rights. But she had no rights. She later told a reporter she wished Lange had never taken her picture. Thompson was still scraping by, living in a mobile home in Modesto, when she died in 1983.
The migrant mother has been incinged and burned into my eyes and my mind since a child.
I just blowed in and I got them dust bowl blues.
LaToya Frazier is a photographer in her early 30s. When she was a teenager, looking at photo history books, she saw the migrant mother picture and asked herself,
well, who's that woman? And how did this image help her, you know, put her own voice out there into the world? Or how did it help her reveal what was happening in those moments for her and her family?
Frazier grew up in Braddock, Pennsylvania, a dying steel town. If migrant farm workers are the picture we have in our head of the Depression, it's places like Braddock that represent hard times now.
If I'm living in this industrial ruin that has been abandoned, and there's no one here from the media covering this, and no one telling our story about what we're dealing with, how do I pick up the camera and agency and start to document it and tell it for myself as a personal subject that did endure these things?
For more than 10 years now, she's been photographing herself, her mother, and her grandparents in Braddock.
This is the hospital being torn down on the right, and it's a diptych that has an image, which is actually my mother receiving an epilepsy test in the hospital. Some of these constant threads in my work dealing with the body and the landscape and the loss of health care and, you know, the way that the body also breaks down and the toxicity of the town. So this very formal way, a very formal poetic way of touching on that visually.
Her goal is not just to document. She wants viewers to know the people in her images like she does. She doesn't want what happened to Florence Thompson to happen to them.
What would Dorothea Lange's own self-portrait look like if she did it herself, of her and her children and her husband, instead of someone from outside that was commissioned by the government?
Today, anyone can document their community. It's not like in Dorothea Lange's time when cameras were for pros. We shoot with our phones, and thanks to apps like Instagram, we have plenty of ways to share our work. But making an image that endures, that's hard. When the economy crashed in 2008, I started seeing the migrant mother a lot. And that made me think, even after the billions of pictures online, we still couldn't come up with our own image of the times we're living through.
I think that great images will continue to bubble to the top, although it is interesting in this era of sort of image proliferation, it's harder and harder.
Sarah Meister is a photography curator at the Museum of Modern Art.
What's amazing about this photograph is that I don't think you need to be a mother to empathize with her. So certainly I look at her and I feel the moment that we're in the world. It's much easier to empathize and to sort of personalize what you think she's going through. At the same time, I don't think that's a necessary requirement for appreciating and feeling the power of this image.
In other words, Meister is saying it's not just about the economy. It's something about the human condition, even if you're not worried about where your next meal is coming from. What that something is, even Lange didn't have the answer. Speaking towards the end of her life in an interview with KQED, she still couldn't explain it.
I have made a few photographs in my life that have really taken hold. It embarrasses me. They're no longer my own. For some peculiar, strange reason that I don't understand, that I haven't the answer for. Why those? There's something in them that has reached people all over. People think I didn't make anything else.
For Studio 360, I'm Charlie Herman.
You can see the migrant mother photograph and the others Lang took on that February day in 1936 at our website, studio360.org. This fall, we will be debuting a brand new season of our Peabody Award-winning series, American Icons. We'll find out how the novel Native Son changed the rules for black writers in America.
Richard Wright was actually saying, let's stop asking for permission. Let's stop apologizing. If you're angry and you know it, clap your hands. You know?
How the Vietnam Memorial changed the way we think about war.
The veterans were asking me before it was built, what do you think people are going to do when they come here? And I wanted to say they're going to cry. But I knew that that would make me even stranger than I'm sure they already thought I was.
And we'll see how Disneyland turned all of us into residents of Fantasyland.
This is the deliciousness of the Disney park in a nutshell, is its tension between commerce and art, tension between storytelling as narrative and storytelling as theme, tension between the adult and the childlike. Those tensions are what keep the tightrope tight.
Those programs and more are all coming up in our new season of American Icons this fall. For the last few years, we've been bringing you the inside stories of the songs the Library of Congress selects to preserve forever. Our series is called Inside the National Recording Registry. It was created by Ben Manila Productions, and it won a Peabody Award last month. Today, we explore the making of a tune from 1980 called He Stopped Loving Her Today. It was so sad, the singer, George Jones, almost didn't record it. And then it became the Country Music Association's Song of the Year for 2 years in a row. To tell the story, we've got a Nashville insider.
My name is Hazel Smith. Country music has been my life all my life. I do a column called Hot Dish for CMT.com, and this is my 15th year of reporting country music news to WFMS in Indianapolis.
The star who recorded the song.
Well, my name is George Jones, and I've been in country music now for many years, ever since about 1956.
And the songwriter, one of the greats.
My name is Bobby Braddock, and I write songs. I guess some of the songs I've written that country music fans would be familiar with would be Time Marches On, Tracy Lawrence, and then Tammy Wynette's D-I-V-O-R-C-E.
Our D-I-V-O-R-C-E becomes final today.
You know, you got a man like Bobby Braddock who wrote, I don't know how many hits for George Jones, Golden Rings and a lot of songs. Now, those were duets with George and Tammy. You know that, don't you?
In a pawn shop in Chicago, on a sunny summer day.
Bobby wrote songs that suited George. The Possum Can Sing.
She smiles and nods her head as he says, honey, that's for you. It's not much, but it's the best that I can do.
When I start singing, I try to live that story and put every bit of heart and soul that I had to offer in the songs. And that's the way I've always felt about recording. You know when a song is pretty good, because if it hits you and just blows smoke everywhere, you know it's got something pretty powerful there.
He said, I'll love you till I die. She told him, you'll forget in time. As the years went slowly by, she still preyed upon his mind.
The plot line of He Stopped Loving Her Today, which I wrote with Curly Putman, is this guy split up with the love of his life, and he just never moved on, and he stopped loving her today because he died today, simply put.
But he still loved her through it all.
He never found out anything about the art of letting go.
Hoping she'd come back again.
The guy was a bad role model.
George thought it was the saddest song he ever heard and wouldn't nobody listen to it.
I kept arguing with my producer. I said Billy Sherrill was my producer at that time. And I said, Billy, it's a beautiful song. It's just too sad.
Billy Sherrill got a lot of criticism in those days for his production being too slick.
He knew I wasn't much of horns and strings and things like that, but strings are beautiful, I found out.
I can tell you right now, the production of He Stopped Loving Her Today did not hurt that song at all. As a matter of fact, if you listen at it, you start to cry.
My favorite part of the record is the ascending string section. Sounds like the guy has died and is on his way to heaven.
He stopped loving her today. They placed a reef upon his door. And soon they'll carry him away. He stopped loving her.
Instead of singing it, Billy Sherrill thought it would be good just to do the recitation.
You know, she came to see him one last time.
You know, it still is the ultimate I love you song, you know.
When George sings the song, The entire audience stands to their feet. They feel like they're in church, do you understand?
This time, he's over her for good. He stopped loving her today.
Country music is the one thing on this planet that is true. And this song, He Stopped Loving Her Today, every word is true. There's no make-believe in it. It's something that, surely to God, it happens sometime.
He stopped loving her today.
He Stopped Loving Her Today, written by Bobby Braddock and sung by George Jones. We heard from both of them, along with Hazel Smith. Ben Manila and Devin Strolovich produced our story. And you can listen to all the stories in our Peabody Award-winning series inside the National Recording Registry at studio360.org. Still ahead today in Studio 360, Jessie Ware might be Britain's hottest new singer, but it took her a while to get the hang of writing pop songs.
Songwriting's like Purple Bananas. It just doesn't make sense. It's so weird to go in a room with somebody who you don't know, maybe, and to try and create this beautiful thing. When I was being a dance vocalist, I was getting beats, and it would be like, trying to keep up and like go with it. But, you know, the joy of writing for yourself is that you can start from scratch.
Jessie Ware performs for us in a minute, right here in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Support for Studio 360 comes from the car company Scion, helping others follow their passions for nearly 10 years. Scion's Motivate program helps young entrepreneurs take their business to the next level. In March, Scion selected 10 semifinalists and will track their success over the next 3 months. Learn more at scion.com. And from Air France, the official carrier for Marseille, Provence 2013, European Capital of Culture, offering 40% more space in premium economy seats. Daily flights to Marseille at airfrance.us. Support for Studio 360's podcast comes from Lumosity. You work out your body, but you might be ignoring your most important muscle, your brain. You can give your brain the workout it needs with a training program designed by the neuroscientists at Lumosity.com and used by researchers at Harvard, Berkeley, and Columbia universities. Learn more about achieving a brighter brain at Lumosity.com.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. It is hard to say what the standard path to pop stardom is these days, but maybe Jessie Ware's story can give us an idea. She spent her early 20s doing journalism and TV production until a musician friend a few years ago asked her to go out on tour with him as a backup singer. That led to vocal work on some dance tracks with London DJs, which led to her own recording contract. Jessie Ware's debut album, Devotion, released last year in the UK, was both a great critical success and a hit. And now it's just being released in the US. Jessie Ware is here with me now. Welcome to Studio 360.
Thanks for having me.
You've just come to the United States. You've been here 3 days.
Yeah, we came straight from Paris where we finished our European tour. So it's kind of straight into the American tour.
How glamorous.
Yeah, it does sound glamorous. It wasn't that glamorous when I was vomiting on the plane because I'd eaten too much steak tartare.
Nice.
But, you know, hey, probably not what you needed to know.
So it is the internet age. This album has been online and hearable by would-be American fans for months and has been reviewed favorably by all the important music blogs. Why this 8-month wait from UK European release to now?
I guess I didn't have a reason to come to America early on because I didn't know whether I had any interest here. So there was no point in spending a load of money schlepping over here and then nobody to know who I was. So I think we just kind of waited. And luckily, it got received really well, the album. And it meant that I could come here and start again, really.
And the necessary pivot to being the star in terms of performance and doing interviews and all that, was that easy?
I always found the interviews really easy because I chat too much anyway, so that was never a problem. The performance stuff, I'm learning. I was quite an apologetic performer right at the beginning because I was like, oh, nobody knows these songs and, oh God, is it self-indulgent? How do I keep them interested? But, you know, I'm now selling out shows and people are coming to see me, so hopefully they know some of the songs and they like them. So it feels a bit easier now.
Will you play one?
Yes.
What will you do?
Wildest Moments?
Excellent.
Okay.
You and I, bloodlines, we come together every time. Two wrongs, no rights, we lose ourselves in night. From the outside, everyone must be wondering why we try. Maybe in our wildest moments, we could be the greatest, we could be the greatest. Maybe in our wildest moments, we could be the worst of all. Maybe in our wildest moments, we could be the greatest, we could be the greatest. Maybe in our wildest moments, we could be the worst of all. Wait on the thunder sky. Wherever there's smoke, there'll soon be fire. And what could bring bad luck? I've been looking at you too much. From the outside, everyone must be wondering why we try. Why do we try? Baby, in our wildest moments, we could be the greatest, we could be the greatest. Maybe in our wildest moments, we could be the worst of all. Baby, in our wildest moments, we could be the greatest, we could be the greatest. Maybe in our wildest moments, we could be the worst of all. In the middle of it, we walk the line. Looking back and missing our wildest moments. Are you thinking, what if? What if we've ruined it all? My wrecking ball. From the outside, from the outside, everyone must be wondering why we try. Why do we try? Maybe in our wildest moments, we could be the worst of all. Baby, in our wildest moments, we could be the greatest, we could be the greatest. Maybe in our wildest moments, we could be the worst of all.
Lovely. That was Jessie Ware on vocals with Joe Newman on guitar playing Wildest Moments from Jessie's debut album Devotion. It's striking to me how different this lovely unplugged acoustic version of this song sounds from this highly produced recording.
Yeah.
You're almost like two different people.
I mean, this song in particular, we wrote this song on a guitar and it had a real country feel to it. And then I kind of hardened it up with the kind of more hip hop beat and like, but you know, I love singing this one acoustically just because I think the song kind of can speak for itself, if I say so myself.
It does. And I'm sure people listening to the lyrics think it's a love song. It must be about a romantic partner. But it's not, right? It's about a friend.
It is a love song, but it's about my best friend, Sarah, yeah.
And what does she think of it?
She loves it. And I think she's really proud of me. And she's been the most supportive friend about – she's very critical and I care about what she thinks so much. And she's taught me so much about music. And then for me to write this song that – people seem to like, and it to be about her, I think she's pretty chuffed.
You said you were a nervous wreck, though, when you started writing. When did you get over that
I think it started to come together when I met the right people to write with. It really is about that chemistry in a room with somebody and feeling you can trust somebody with getting it wrong or your words or understanding what you're trying to say. And my manager had met Dave at a barbecue, Dave Okumu, my producer. And he said, oh, I think you'll get on with Jesse. And so we go into the studio and it was like almost like a therapy session as soon as we met. And I was like, oh God, I just don't know how to do it. And he said, you know, songwriting's like purple bananas. It just doesn't make sense. It's so weird to go in a room with somebody who you don't know, maybe, and to try and create this beautiful thing. It varies. When I was being a dance vocalist, I was getting beats and it would be like, trying to keep up and like go with it. But, you know, the joy of writing for yourself is that you can start from scratch.
And you don't play an instrument?
No.
Will you?
If I ever cut these false nails off, Joe, my guitarist, says he'll teach me, but I have to get rid of the false nails and I just can't part with them at the moment, which is terrible, isn't it, in vain?
Well, vanity is, you know, part of being a pop diva as you
become one, I guess, right? I'm going to get rid of them or I'm just going to learn classical guitar or Spanish guitar.
And you use them. 10 picks.
Exactly.
Will you play another song?
Yes.
What's this one?
This is Running.
Excellent.
Okay.
Your words alone could drive me to 1,000 tears. All the same words that kept me here for all the years. I'm lost again, it's happening. When you're around, I just go weak. All I want to know is in your chihuahua, then I never want to leave. Ready to run, ready to fall. Think I'm ready to lose it all. Ready to run, ready to fall. Think I'm ready to lose it all. Ooh. Keep me running, keep me running. Keep me running, keep me running. Keep me running, keep me running. Keep me running. You keep me. Keep me running. Oh, would you hold me lightly, ever so gently here? Would you never give up? Never give up. Oh, would you pull me in close and nobody knows we're there? No one can find us. I'm lost again, it's happening. When you're around, I just go weak. All I want to know is I'm mutual. Then I never want to leave. Ready to run, ready to fall. Think I'm ready to lose it all. Ready to run, ready to fall. Think I'm ready to lose it all. Ooh. Keep me running, keep me running. Keep me running, you keep me running. Keep me running, you keep me running. Keep me running. And I'm lost again, it keeps happening. But when I'm around you, when I'm around you, I just go weak. All I wanna know is a mutual. Am I ready to run? Am I ready to fall? Think I'm ready just to lose it all. You keep me running. Keep me running. You keep me running. Give up, give up, give up, give up, give up, give up. Keep me running. Would you never give up, give up, give up, give up, give up, give up? You keep me.
That was Running from Jesse Ware's debut album, Devotion. which comes out April 16th in the United States. Joe Newman was playing guitar. That is one of a bunch of songs on this record in which I hear 80s echoes, yeah. You know, Sade or Whitney Houston or Annie Lennox or somebody. You were six when the decade ended. Were you just listening to old music as you grew up?
Whitney Houston, we used to play the tapes all the time. The album which had like "I'm Your Baby Tonight" and "My Name Is Not Susan," and we'd be singing all these songs in the back of the car and be like, "My name is not Susan," but kind of
how
that,
cute,
yeah, quite cute. But yeah, I think you know I've really appreciated Annie Lennox as an older person going back to that album Diva and just being like, wow. These are great songs. And Sade, yeah, I kind of fell more in love with her in my 20s.
Uh-huh. So what is it with South London right now? I mean, it's sort of like when Brooklyn became a musical epicenter 15 years ago. Now, I mean, you, your schoolmate Florence of The Machine, Adele, The XX, why did this suddenly become this wellspring?
I don't know. And everyone asks me this. And I can't really answer it. Maybe it's that seeing our friends getting signed, I think it inspires. It can happen. It can happen if you work hard.
And you're also friends with the giant of pop, Adele, as well.
Yes.
So you joining them as the three hottest pop singers in the UK now, I mean, that's kind of extraordinary. You should go start a premature supergroup or something.
Who would get lead? I think Adele would have to. I'd be back. I'd be happy to be back in singer. It'd be cool.
There you go. Jessie Ware, thank you for coming into Studio 360.
Cheers. Thanks for having me.
Jessie Ware's Devotion is out in the U.S. this week. She's on tour in North America this month. You can see some video of her performance today online at studio360.org. And that's it for this hour of Studio 360. Thank you very much for listening. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Jenny Lawton,
John Delore,
Sean Ramisferam,
Alana Harper,
Anne Hepperman,
Rick Kwan,
Shannon Geis,
Julia Lowry Henderson.
Thanks, as always, to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tegum. You can follow us on Twitter, at Studio 360 Show and at KB Anderson. That's Anderson with an E. You can also find us on Facebook.
Support for Studio 360 comes from the car company Scion, helping others follow their passions for nearly 10 years. Scion's Motivate program helps young entrepreneurs take their business to the next level. In March, Scion selected 10 semifinalists and will track their success over the next 3 months. Learn more at scion.com. Studio 360 is funded in part by Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees, and by the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Support for Studio 360's podcast comes from the car company Scion. As part of its Motivate program, Scion invited 50 semifinalists to L.A., where they were provided mentors, attended seminars, and met with advisors. Then, the 10 that most improved received $10,000, a Scion, and continued access to mentors. You can track their success at scion.com.
Next time in Studio 360, we're always going on and on about creativity. In fact, we don't know what we're talking about.
When you start to study it and start to try to figure out what it is and specify its constituents, it becomes more and more and more confusing. Nobody agrees on what it is.
The truth about creativity. That's next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.